Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. We're coming to you a couple days early because we just couldn't wait to get all this great political news to you, right, Jay?
Yes, definitely, definitely. And you know what? We have been inundated with some awesome and wonderful emails from our great listeners. And I don't know if you know this, Brandon, we have probably the smartest listeners out there.
I couldn't agree more.
Exactly. So much so that they catch us when we make really silly little errors. Like, for example, last week, I want to thank our friend Alfonso, who is from Dallas, but we're not going to hold that against him.
He's probably not a Rangers fan. That's probably okay there.
But he was kind enough to point out that I made a big mistake last week. We talked about the poisoning of two Russian nationals in the UK. Unfortunately, I think I killed them off a little prematurely.
You did. How does it feel, Jay, to make your first mistake ever?
Yes, I know.
Ever.
This must be what it feels like to be Donald Trump.
That's what it feels like to be me, Jay.
No. Well, after that apology, I probably should introduce myself yet again. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout as we talk all things political, Texas, national, a little local every now and then. But yes, we are here to talk politics, and we have had quite a week, Brandon. A lot's happening. What caught your eye?
Well, speaking of mistakes, Jay, you're not the only one who makes mistakes. Also, apparently, EPA Director Pruitt has made some mistakes, or at least he's gotten involved in a couple of issues that have caught national attention. The first is that the EPA was considering renting a private plane for him to fly around. Presumably, he needs his plane to fly over the swamp that President Trump is draining, but that's a different problem. Now, he's also apparently increased the salary of a couple of his employees without the authorization from the White House and in a way that maybe doesn't square with the statute ability to do so. And he also is under some fire for renting an apartment from a wife of a lobbyist who had lobbied on some issues in front of the EPA. So there's a couple of different issues going on here that directly involve Pruitt. I'm not sure this resonates too clearly with the president's desire to sort of change the direction of government.
Yeah, I don't think it does. And you throw in the fact that he's already been criticized and I think punished or had to repay at least for using first class travel, over $160,000 for first class travel in and around for events. And that doesn't even include the fact he's military aircraft at times as well. So all this comes against the backdrop of pretty significant regulatory reform that Secretary Pruitt put in to essentially roll back most of the Obama-era standards on general environmental protection. He's now gone after, while we're not looking at paying attention to this stuff.
The private plane, maybe.
Exactly, private plane, private plane. We're now looking at the fact that they want to roll back CAFE standards. That's the average gasoline standards, gas mileage per gallon standards. Back again, rolling back Obama-era regulations, in some cases that were responsible for auto manufacturers upping the miles per gallon requirement, thanking him for, of course, ironically, the manufacturers for doing it. But I guess we've cured all our oil dependency woes, so we don't need it anymore.
It's all fixed, right? Well, Jay, I've got a post-it note here that says, don't congratulate, don't invite. I don't know what it means, though, Jay. What could it refer to? Are we going to talk to a head of state later on?
Yeah, exactly. We might be. Well, if it happens to be the president of Russia, one Vladimir Putin, that would be our president, Donald Trump, in congratulating him on his...
Do not congratulate.
Yes, resounding victory in an election that most people thought was fraudulent. He also invited him for a head of state visit to the United States.
Yeah, so part of this discussion apparently is going to be about some of the arms race issues that have come up with respect to Syria, the Ukraine, and North Korea. We joke he didn't have a post note that said don't invite, but the way that foreign dignitaries get invited isn't through an informal discussion over the phone. It has to be set up, and there are protocols in place for these kinds of things. And to be honest, given the relationship with Russia and the United States right now, it's not so clear this is a good move for the president. Getting that political closeness is potentially problematic for him.
We know the president has made a habit of this. He did a similar thing where he accepted an invitation from the president of North Korea for bilateral conversation. Technically, we don't want to talk about a negotiation because that's something that we're not negotiating anything yet, but it was an initial conversation. And as it relates to President Putin, this is coming just in the aftermath of pretty significant sanctions where we sent back 60 Russian diplomats who apparently are going to be able to replace them with a whole new set of Russian diplomats. And we shut down a consulate in Seattle area. So this is a very unusual thing.
So where should this be, Jay? Should we do Atlantic City, Vegas? Like, what's the venue?
That would be a great listener poll. So email us your suggestions where you think we should be doing this. My vote is some sort of Trump property. You know what? It has to be a Trump property.
Yeah.
Preferably with a golf course.
Right. Well, we've also had some interesting dynamics taking place all over the country, actually. We've got a bunch of teacher strikes. West Virginia has had issues, Kentucky, and now Oklahoma. So what's going on there?
Yeah, so we're seeing this national wave where teachers' organizations, teachers themselves, are essentially fed up with the reductions and cuts to their salaries and just a lack of general investment in public education. And this is kind of a bit of a watershed moment. We're seeing the civil disobedience that took place in West Virginia, where they essentially went on strike for several weeks, bringing state government to a standstill to essentially force an increase in salary. In Oklahoma, the stakes are, I think, incredibly high. There was a news report out that the average Oklahoma salary for a teacher is about $35,000 a year. Routinely, they've gone to a four-day school day as a result of this because they simply can't afford to do it. Oklahoma, like Kansas before it, has been dealing with a lot of their budgetary issues by just wholesale cuts to public education. And here in Texas, Texas teachers, I think, are feeling the brunt. Brandon, is this kind of a red state, blue state? I mean, are we oversimplifying it by saying that? Because we know there's been sort of this trend of kind of low tax, low service states that are under investing in education. Are we seeing a pretty strong pushback now, or has the tide turned?
Yeah, I think that as you said, that the cuts have finally gotten to the bone, and now the teachers are not happy. Seeing the pictures that were being sent out and tweeted out of the textbooks that were being used in these classrooms was completely unacceptable. And if you live in these states, you have to recognize that there is a point at which that you have to be able to invest more money in this. You mentioned Texas. We are 27th in the nation in teacher pay. Our average salary is $51,000, which is about $6,000 below the national average. So we are doing okay comparatively, but still low in comparison. So I don't know that we're talking about teachers taking to the streets, but you definitely saw, and we've talked about this before, teachers taking to the ballot box to be able to advocate for what they like. Is there any group you'd rather cross less than teachers, Jay, right? They're going to come with a sea of red ink on these bills with a big F on top of it. Like, you failed. We need more money. We need to help our kids. That's a big function of what state government does.
Well, when you think of it this way, though, I mean, the Texas education system has been dealing with numerous issues as it relates to funding. It's gone to court almost on an annual basis about whether or not the system is constitutional or not. We know that teachers themselves haven't had a pay raise in quite some time and just adjusted for inflation. They're actually sort of losing money.
And the money that the state is supposed to contribute to the health insurance premiums also hasn't risen for 15 years. So that's cutting into the salary technically of these teachers as well.
Well, speaking of Texas, speaking of teachers, we've got, and speaking of elections, we've got the big election here in Texas is for the U.S. Senate. And our junior senator, Ted Cruz, announced for re-election. I don't know if you know this, Brandon, but he's Texas tough.
He is, apparently, according to the kind of theme that he's wanting to produce, right? He has definitely connected his candidacy to Harvey and to the relief efforts. I'm not sure if he's trying to imply that he's spearheading these, because I'm not sure that that could be true. And I suspect that John Cornyn may have something to say about that. But he definitely wants to use that as a theme. So he's kicked off a series of events and is traveling the state, which, to be honest, it seems like he needs, since O'Rourke has put a pretty serious amount of hay in the barn. It was disclosed just today that he put up a pretty big number, raising about $6.5 million from 141,000 contributors. So this is compared to Cruz's $800,000. We don't know exactly how much he'll raise this particular point to the cycle, but it looks like O'Rourke is really on his heels here and in some ways beating him.
Yeah, he's on pace to raise close to $20 to $25 million. 141,000 donors, that's like an average spend of about $50. He can go back to that well a lot. What you're smelling from Ted Cruz is the smell of fear, because this is going to be a real race, something we haven't seen in Texas in a very long time. Ted Cruz's ad put out an ad when he announced, "Craziest thing I've seen, zombie apocalypse. kind of the idea of what could potentially happen if Ted Cruz loses. It is a wild ad, but I think it speaks to something interesting. He is having to reassure conservatives and get conservatives and Republicans excited about him and about this race, because I think real concern that Beto O'Rourke and Democrats in Texas have some level of momentum. Cruz, to his credit, I think has been leading on this. He's been talking about the fact that he genuinely is taking the race seriously. Sounds like, at least from a money perspective, he's right about this. This race will be close.
Yeah, he can't cruise on this, no pun intended, right? He really has to put his shoulder into it. And the fact that he knows how to run a race like that, like he did in 2012, especially in the runoff, shows that he can make this happen. And I think O'Rourke has shown that he can be competitive. He's a credible candidate. And I don't know that the millions of dollars he's raising here is going to be enough to unseat what is a traditional advantage for an incumbent Republican in Texas, but it definitely shows that he's credible, and that can definitely move the needle a bit.
Well, looking at other elections, Brandon, we've got two interesting potential special elections have popped up for really entirely different reasons. Carlos Uresti down in the Valley has been convicted of fraud, several felony counts. That seat's going to be open. You've got declared candidates, except for one problem. He hasn't resigned yet.
Right. It's like a presidential race where people are lining up to skin your hide 2 years before you're up for re-election, right? Yeah, you have Roland Gutierrez, who's a representative from San Antonio, has put up political signs. He's developed a network and got people backing him. You also have Pete Gallego, former state and federal representative, who's preparing a bid and announcing. So they've lined up with the assumption that Uresti will resign. I don't know if he will. But the same thing, something similar, we'll say, is happening here in Houston in SD6.
Yeah, absolutely. Sylvia Garcia, who's a state senator from Senate District 6, won her primary to replace Congressman Gene Green. It's a foregone conclusion. She will be a member of Congress, especially in that district. We've got two heavyweights, local heavyweights, in State Representative Carol Alvarado and State Representative Ana Hernandez, that have both declared. Same kind of thing. We're just waiting to see what happens. The key thing to remember is, if we don't have a resignation by sometime in August, the governor cannot call a special election in time to be on the November ballot. And that means the state of Texas is going to have to spend $2 million for special elections. And those two Senate seats will sit unfilled during a good chunk of the next legislative session.
The state needs that money because they need to prosecute people who are voting while on probation, right?
Absolutely. Crazy story, Brandon. A woman who was sentenced in Tarrant County to 5 years for voting while on probation. What's going on?
Wow. This is definitely part of this crackdown that the Republican Party has pursued on people who engage in voting fraud. This woman had been released from federal prison on tax charges, but was on probation. She voted during that time, which made her a felon under Texas law. Voting in person and having that end up in fraud is a pretty rare thing, but this is something that the Republicans have really demonized. So I'm all for election security, but this seems pretty extreme.
So I think what's going to happen is this case is going to get appealed all the way to the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah.
And I think they're going to—
Cruel and unusual punishment?
Exactly. And they're going to overturn this because your right to vote is a fundamental right.
Interesting.
And there's a question as to whether or not this will fall through. So I think it's actually an interesting test case. But, I mean, at the very least, 5 years is just— whoever sentenced her should recognize the proportionality on the punishment side. Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the big issue of this week, this sort of the last few weeks, and that's this ongoing issue surrounding NAFTA, DACA, and the big wall that may never get built.
Well, Jay, we referenced Texas Tough with respect to what Senator Cruz was using as a message to run for re-election. But we've got lots of issues in Texas that are going on. We have DACA. We have the potential for NAFTA to be torn up, as the president has implied. We also have the wall, which, as you say, may or may not get built, depending on how much money is thrown at it. So what exactly is happening here, and what effect does it have on Texas?
Yeah, so we've got the big national issue of sort of this trifecta, right? Immigration reform, trade changes, and what to do with this wall that just has to get built, according to the president. So those three issues kind of permeated the 2016 presidential campaign and were kind of buttressed by what to do with DACA, which was the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals that President Obama had granted this temporary status for childhood immigrants who are here.
Now, the president this over Easter weekend said no DACA, right? What did he mean by that?
No DACA. He basically is saying he's linked everything together, which is something that's a little bit unusual. Trade and reform with the NAFTA rewrite that he wants to do with Mexico and Canada, DACA reform and larger immigration reform and building the wall. He's essentially said that all three of them are linked together. Unless you give me all three, nothing's going to get done.
Yeah. And he needs leverage, right? Now, so he didn't get the money for the wall that he wanted in the most recent budget that was passed, right? So that's one problem that he's facing. I think that irked him, and I think that's probably prompting a lot of this. Another reason that he needs more leverage is that he was, for a time, threatening to basically couple DACA with the budget, right? I won't sign the budget if you don't give me some kind of DACA reform. That went away, too, when he signed the budget, right? Because there wasn't any DACA discussion in that. So he needs to re-inject himself into this, and he needs leverage. I'm not sure this is the way to do it. Congress seems to be making plans without him, right? The wall funding is low. NAFTA is in place, and people have only, I think, a half-hearted effort to redesign that. And at least in principle, there's a discussion about moving DACA forward. So I don't know what he's after here in terms of trying to get himself back into this political picture.
Yeah, so the issue with DACA, I think, ends up being that unless you can get some sort of congressional bipartisan support to do larger immigration reform, you're not going to see, I think, some of the pieces come together. The president, I think, is just a spectator in this process. And I think your point's well taken. He's trying to, I think, make himself more relevant in this process and use DACA and NAFTA as a means to get the wall that he wants to get built. We thought there had been some sort of compromise and he'd pull back. You know, he said, you know, walls don't necessarily mean walls. They can mean fencing and in some areas. And he could have claimed victory, but apparently he feels compelled to, I think, re-inject it and say he wants that $20 billion. He got about 1.5 in this last budget. He wants the full amount in order to construct what he perceives is important. And against this entire backdrop, he's using this annual migration of immigrants from Central America through Mexico that historically has come. And every year when they try to come over, they've been arrested at the border, sent back. He's now suggesting, well, without a wall, I'm going to send the U.S. military down there and essentially militarizing part of the border.
Yeah. I wonder if he's poisoning the well on this. I think that, you know, he had implied he wanted to have some kind of DACA reform. And like you say, there was some discussion to make that happen. I think Congress could make this happen without him. But now that he's essentially made this a political hot potato, it's much more difficult to do. In terms of the wall, there's, I think, evidence that the number of crossings is down and has been going down for a long time. And part of this is because the state has been spending a lot of money, up to $800 million on border security. And the efforts that have been put into this have been successful. So before the time he was in office, we definitely saw some progress in terms of limiting that. Now, that's not to say that it's perfect, because it can't be, because you're keeping people on one side of a country when you've got demand for them to come here. But it is definitely the case that there is success here.
Yeah, I mean, the irony of it is that Attorney General Paxton likes to sue the federal government. What we haven't seen is a lawsuit against the federal government for repayment of about $1.5 billion.
Where's our money, right?
Exactly. Where's our money? You would think they would be inclined to do that, because in some ways that would bolster the argument for President Trump. So it's interesting that they don't try that. But I think the interesting thing is how NAFTA has fallen into this, because where the president, I think, sees he has leverage is dealing with Mexico. He's looking for a way to both fund the wall and also to clamp down on immigrants. He thinks NAFTA might be the way to do it and force Mexico to act, except politics come into play. Mexico is in the middle of a very heated election. It's very unlikely right now, if you look at their polling, that President Nieto's party is even going to retain power. So it's unclear as to what we're going to see coming out of Mexico and how they're going to want to renegotiate
NAFTA. It could be a lot worse for Trump if it goes in that direction, right? NAFTA is an unusual thing for Texas, because it itself, that trade deal accounts for about $125 billion in exports and about 500,000 jobs in the state of Texas alone. So I don't know that going away is something that the state would like. But looking at polling, it is the case that 44% of Texans say that these trade deals are bad for the economy, and 60% of Republicans say that it's bad for the economy. So one question I was thinking about was, where is the Texas delegation and all this? Why aren't they pushing back on these issues, right? Like, the number of DACA recipients in Texas is higher than average, right? NAFTA impacts the state much more than most other states. The wall clearly is built literally in our backyard. So why isn't it the case that we see pushback? And I think part of it is that these are things that Republicans in Texas generally support. So not surprisingly, perhaps the politics of this get wrapped up into it.
Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Brandon, let's talk about what we think is going to happen here. Are we going to see a wall? Are we going to see a new NAFTA? What's going to happen with DACA?
So, Jay, we run down a couple of these big issues that have become political issues that are clearly, though, economic issues and legal issues, international issues. So what's going to happen with La Frontera, right? This is the borderland, right? There are all kinds of problems, but all kinds of solutions. What are we going to see happen, if anything?
Look, I don't think we're going to see an actual wall. I think we're going to see a continuation of what we've got, which is more enhanced security at the border. I think NAFTA is going to continue to exist for the exact reason you said. It is good business, particularly for folks here in Texas. Texas would suffer greatly if NAFTA went away. And we all, as we all know, for the United States to be strong, Texas has to be strong. And as it relates to DACA and immigration reform, I'm pretty pessimistic right now. I'm not sure we're going to see a solution to the issue surrounding DACA until after the midterm elections. We'll see what happens there politically. But at this point, I don't think you're going to see any real changes.
I agree with you on the first two. I think that the likelihood of the wall being built is pretty low. This is a promise that the president likes to make, and I think he can claim as much credit for it as he's going to get, right? That's not going to pay off for him. Congress won't give him that money. NAFTA, I think, is going to maintain itself. You'll see some renegotiation, but it's too important to the U.S. economy to go away in its current form. I'm more optimistic on DACA. I do think that there's bipartisan support to be able to push for a bill. The problem is the president keeps poisoning the well. And if they make immigration the central issue in the 2018 election, then it's going to make it much more difficult for the members of the disparate parties to agree on something. I don't know if it'll happen before or after, but I think it'll happen at some point.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Any questions? Shoot us a tweet with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod or email us at PartyPoliticsPod@HoustonPublicMedia.org. Thanks to our ever-present producer, Edel Halland, who would never close a border on us, and to our engineer, Todd Hawkeye Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rodinghouse. See you next week.